fellow, Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University, out of Budapest. And thank you so much for staying with us for another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Mathalul ladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillahi kamathali حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلٍ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ فِي كُلِّ سُنْبُلَةٍ مِئَةُ حَبَّةٍ وَاللَّهُ يُضَاعِفُ لِمَنْ يَشَاءُ وَاللَّهُ وَاسِعٌ عَلِيمٌ مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبٍّ أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. President Ebrahim Raisi says the Iranian nation has thwarted Western sanctions imposed on their country by focusing on trade and production growth. Syria says U.S. occupying forces provide terrorist groups with chemical weapons to use them in gas attacks and blame the Syrian government. And Nigeria's president says diplomacy is the best way to resolve the ongoing political crisis in Niger without ruling out military intervention. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. Iran's president has highlighted the country's remarkable progress in the fields of science, technology, industry, and production. Despite Western threats, Ebrahim Raisi says Iran has taken huge steps to neutralize sanctions by focusing on trade and production growth. Raisi was speaking in a meeting with Vietnam's National Assembly Chairman Vuong Dinh Hue in Tehran. He said the visit can be a turning point for the two countries to expand economic and trade cooperation. He said Iran and Vietnam are both independence-seeking nations. The Vietnamese official, for his part, hailed Iran's achievements despite hardships. He said Vietnam seeks to promote all-out cooperation with Iran to the international level. On Tuesday, Iran and Vietnam signed a memorandum of understanding for parliamentary cooperation.
The chairman of the National Assembly of Vietnam, Vuong Dinh Hue, arrived in Tehran heading a high-level parliamentary delegation at an invitation of his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Baghir Ghalibaf. In a meeting, the visiting Vietnamese parliament speaker expressed hope that during this trip, the two countries would be able to expand and develop economic and commercial cooperation, as the countries enjoy a lot of capacity for economic cooperation and investment. Iran's parliament speaker, for his part, said Iran's priority in foreign policy is to pay special attention to East Asian states, including Vietnam, due to existing cultural commonalities. Right after the meeting, Iran and Vietnam signed a memorandum of understanding to expand parliamentary cooperation.
Parliamentary diplomacy between the two countries can prepare the ground for strengthening bilateral ties at both regional and international levels. Further efforts should be made to strengthen cultural, tourism, scientific and academic cooperation between the two countries and promote the exchange of citizens' visits by facilitating visa issuance, launching a direct flight between Tehran and Hanoi, and setting up a joint banking committee between the two countries can also facilitate the promotion of bilateral relations.
Vietnam attaches great importance to the significant role of Iran in the West Asian region.
Our country pays attention to the policy of strengthening friendship and cooperation between Iran and Vietnam in various parliamentary and governmental areas. The problem of financial exchange between the two countries can be solved by establishing a banking committee between the two countries.
Both sides have frequently supported each other in international organizations, particularly at the United Nations, to uphold multilateralism, build a multipolar world order, and respect the sovereignty and legitimate interests of nations and people. According to official reports, the volume of trade between the two nations surpassed $120 million 2 years ago, but the number has the potential to reach $2 billion in the future.
Observers believe that the visit to Tehran by Speaker of the Vietnamese Parliament after 24 years is seen as a turning point in bilateral ties, especially as it coincides with the 50th anniversary of the establishment of diplomatic relations between Iran and Vietnam. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Close relations between Iran and Russia have raised eyebrows in the West. The Russian deputy foreign minister now says Moscow and Tehran remain determined to expand cooperation in various fields.
It's fully legitimate and very substantial part of our interaction. It will continue despite all the attempts by our enemies, enemies of Russia and enemies of Iran to disrupt and derail. It will not happen. We have full right to develop and enhance this cooperation. And full political resolve to do so. Leaders guide us in this area, and bureaucracies, administrations work accordingly. And our military people will also see further contacts and further interaction.
Sergei Ryabkov was speaking in Tehran on the sidelines of a meeting of the prospects for partnership and cooperation between Iran and BRICS. He also touched upon stalled talks on the restoration of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. The Russian official blamed the U.S. and the three European signatories to the JCPOA for the deadlock regarding its revival.
The future of JCPOA truly depends on what our colleagues in the U.S. And in the European Union decide for themselves. I know for sure that our Iranian friends are ready to come back to the original JCPOA with adjustments that were agreed upon for the bulk of it last year. But for reasons unrelated to JCPOA, the Westerners once again abused the situation and tried to squeeze all sorts of irrelevant concessions out of Iran.
The Russian foreign ministry also weighed in on the matter in a statement. It said failure to implement the JCPOA stems from the, quote, erroneous policy of maximum pressure pursued by the U.S. and those who think similarly. The statement also dismissed as unacceptable the Western sanctions regime over the Iranian nuclear program. The ministry said there's still no reasonable alternative to the implementation of the deal. A top Syrian official slammed U.S. forces for facilitating chemical attacks in the Arab country. Syria's deputy permanent representative to the UN said the occupation forces provided terrorists with the material and training to use them in alleged chemical attacks.
The U.S. continues its attempts to exploit the chemical weapons file to serve their agenda of hostility against Syria. Available information shows that its military forces that are illegally situated have provided a terrorist group with toxic chemical substances and trained them in their use.
Dani made the remarks at a recent meeting of the UN Security Council. He said the U.S. sought to frame Damascus in a chemical attack. The Syrian officials said the monthly meetings on what they call Syrian chemical file creates opportunities for certain states to level repeated accusations against Damascus. Dandy called on all parties to refrain from providing misinformation and politicizing the issue in favor of Western countries. Dandy slammed certain states for ignoring Syria's cooperation with the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. He stressed the stance of Damascus in rejecting the use of chemical weapons under any circumstances. The Lebanese army has organized a tour to offer explanations about the Blue Line, a temporary line drawn after the withdrawal of Israel from the country's territory in the year 2000. Though Lebanon does not recognize the Blue Line as its official border, Israel constantly violates it without any accountability. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh has more from Lebanon's southern city of Naqoura.
The Lebanese National Army has organized a tour for the diplomatic representatives and members of the United Nations Security Council to show them the places of disputes between Lebanon and Israel and Tel Aviv's violations all along Lebanon's southern borders. The first stop was in the Naqoura area B1, where the first Israeli violation in the sea was spotted at the venue in 1967. The coordinator of the Lebanese government at the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, Brigadier General Munir Shahadi, told reporters that the army has recorded thousands of Israeli violations in the sea, land, and air, in addition to permanent violations. Meanwhile, Lebanese army spokesman provided foreign delegations a briefing on the disputed area.
But before the brief, please have a look on the illustrative sketch of the current situation at Naqoura Bayhead. Here have the tunnel entrance on Lebanese side. The blue line is withdrawal line, blue line. And the green line is the international borders green line. And the red line is permanent violation of Israeli enemy forces, technical fence on Lebanese territories. And the red triangle here is the violation area.
After a briefing from the Lebanese army, some of the diplomatic representatives gave their observations.
We heard from our friends in the Lebanese army about their argument concerning more than one area on the border. We believe it is very important to find a solution to these disputes. We in Russia always support the Lebanese government, and we support any diplomatic and peaceful efforts to resolve these violations.
When asked about the obvious Israeli violations, the UK's military attaché did not have a clear answer.
There's clearly progress that needs to be made in terms of agreeing where the demarcation lines are, both in terms of the land and on the sea. So we know that there is more work that needs to be done between the two countries to make that clearer.
The tour comes days before the United Nations Security Council renews the annual mandate of the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, which was originally established to confirm the withdrawal of Israeli forces after its first invasion in 1978. The Lebanese army has refused any attempted mediation by the U.S. to work on a new land demarcation, stressing that they do not recognize the blue line as an official border line, since Lebanon's official border with occupied Palestine are internationally recognized. The Lebanese army has confirmed through its tour today that the blue line drawn in 2000 is a withdrawal line and not an official border. The Israelis have not only violated the international border demarcated in 1923 between Lebanon and Palestine, but have violated the blue line on a daily basis since the end of the 2006 war. Mariam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
Israel takes yet another step to add to the sufferings of Palestinians. The regime has frozen the funds of Palestinian councils in East Al-Quds. Israeli finance minister Bezalel Smotrich has announced the freezing of millions of dollars meant for local councils and educational programs, citing crime and safety fears. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has also backed the decision. However, several Israeli officials have strongly criticized the plan, saying it will promote hatred and racism. The five-year funds plan approved in 2018 was the regime's acknowledgement of years-long social and economic inequality against Palestinians. Israel's oppression of Palestinians has intensified, especially under the far-right cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu, who assumed office last December. The regime has resorted to any form of brutal measure, including daily raids, detention, and killing of Palestinians to constrain their activities. Researcher and political analyst Christopher Halali joined us earlier and gave us his take on the Israeli regime's decision to freeze the Palestinian funds.
Once again, this is confirmation of the apartheid regime, of the apartheid policies, of the racism and neocolonialism of the leaders of, you know, Israel against the people of Palestine, the indigenous people of the land. And so what we are seeing here is another confirmation to the world. No matter the propaganda, no matter the Hasbara, Israel can no longer conceal the fact that it is an apartheid regime, that it has racist policies, that it has two classes of people, Jews and those who are non-Jews, especially those who are, you know, Arabs and the minority, you know, in the land. And of course, it's important to recognize that you know, this, the withholding of $85.5 million in aid only furthers the goals of stoking division, of stoking hatred, and that's what they want. They want conflict, they don't want peace, they want war, and they want ethnic cleansing, and they're going to get it, you know, if they have their way. But the resistance has been so profound that even today, some foreign policy experts said that basically the Israeli government is pushing Palestinians who were not so political into very profound revolutionary action. And that's very important and key to understanding this development today.
The UK plays host to Israeli weapons manufacturer Elbit Systems, which is said to be providing the majority of the drones used by the regime's military. In the past few years, pro-Palestinian protest network Palestine Action has forced two of the company's multiple UK-based sites to close up shop through direct action, and as Saeed Puraza reports, the group has spearheaded a siege of the company's site in the East Midlands of England for more than 3 months now.
Rain or shine, they've been here for more than 3 months. Palestine supporters from the local community and from afar camped out outside a weapons factory owned by Israel's largest arms company, Elbit Systems, in Leicester, England. Their aim, to shut it down, for good. Beyond the steel fence and barbed wire, Elbit's drones factory that activists say accounts for the majority of the Israeli regime's UAV fleet, which the company denies. Outside, reminders of how Israel uses them.
Israeli arms factories that are in Britain. And this particular one makes drones and other types of munitions and components. Elbit collectively make just about every single piece of weaponry that you can think of. It's really imperative we shut this particular factory down. It has six armed export licenses worth £5 million a year that go to Israel that are then used to terrorize and bomb the Palestinian people.
It all started 100 days ago when Palestine Action members laid siege to the site. But they were arrested and removed by police in May for, quote, conspiracy to do criminal damage.
Palestine Action have laid siege to the company across the country for the past 2 years, leading to the permanent closure of two sites and costing the company more than $400 million in lost contracts with the British Ministry of Defense. The void, after they were forcibly removed from here, has been filled in by other pro-Palestinian activists, among them Leicester locals, who say this site here is next.
The two closed sites included Elbit's London headquarters and a factory in Greater Manchester, the result of Palestine Action's sustained campaign of direct action in the past 2 years. But it hasn't been easy for them.
Back in May, we were arrested. Most of the Palestine Action people were arrested, and we were given bail conditions. They took our phones and they gave us bail conditions not to be by the site. So what it's meant is that all the people who were really committed routinely were not able to support holding the site.
Yet none of that has fazed these activists, who say every moment an Elbit site is forced to close is a triumph for the Palestinian cause. Saeed Puraza, London.
Russia says it has downed two combat drones headed for Moscow, the latest in a series of such attacks targeting the capital. Moscow mayor says the two drones, one in the Domodedovo area and the second in the Minsk highway area, were shot down by the air defense. The mayor did not elaborate on who carried out the attack. The assault comes more than 1 week after at least one person was injured in an overnight drone attack in Moscow. A number of buildings were also damaged as a result. The attack also briefly shut an international airport there. The Kremlin blamed Ukraine for the strike, but Kiev denied the allegation. Several such attacks have happened in the past, including the one on the Kremlin in May. Nigeria has not ruled out military intervention in Niger. In the wake of the recent coup in the country, a spokesperson for President Bola Tinubu says he and other West African leaders favor a diplomatic solution, but no options have been taken off the table. Tinubu has also slapped Niger with new sanctions in an effort to squeeze those involved in the coup. The sanctions were imposed after the junta in Niger denied a joint delegation from the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, the African Union, and the United Nations to enter the capital, Niamey, for negotiations. Junta leaders have cited security concerns as the reason behind their decision. President Bazoum was removed from power on July 26. ECOWAS has pledged to deploy all measures in order to restore constitutional order in Niger. That's a wrap for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیبه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk. Whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The Zionist regime's policies have often forced Palestinian families apart. Parents in Gaza sometimes have to bring up children alone while the other parent works and lives in the West Bank. As a result, families are only able to keep in touch by telephone or the internet. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Enterprise wrote, Soheir Hanoun is unable to see her mother. Raised in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, where her mother still lives, Soheir moved to Gaza more than two decades ago. In 2021, the Israeli regime military informed Soheir that she had to sign a document after visiting her mother. The document was mostly in Hebrew, a language Soheir does not understand. When she asked what the document contained, the Israeli troops at Erez, the military checkpoint separating Gaza and the occupied territories of Palestine, refused to say. The Zionist regime troops just told Soheir that if she did not sign, she would not be allowed to enter Gaza and see her husband, Ibrahim, and their children. A few days later, Soheir showed the document to a human rights group. She was shocked when she heard what she had consented to by signing it. The document was effectively a declaration that Soheir was making Gaza her permanent residence. She would not be allowed to enter the West Bank again unless she submitted a relocation application. Soheir, who is in her late 40s, has tried to visit her mother since signing the document. But the Zionist regime has repeatedly rejected her requests for travel permits. She did file a relocation application in the hope of being allowed to live in the West Bank. But the Zionist regime rejected her request. Soheir said, "It feels like I have been exiled." She had been planning to move to the West Bank with her children. Doing so, she added, was necessary to give the children a happy future away from all the attacks on Gaza and the hard living conditions they have experienced. The Zionist regime began pressuring people from the West Bank entering Gaza via the Erez checkpoint to sign permanent residence declarations in 2009. Although the obligation to sign such papers was dropped after a few years, the Zionist regime has recently reintroduced it. Even before she was forced to sign the declaration, Soheir had trouble getting permits for travel between Gaza and the West Bank. She has only seen her mother and siblings in Nablus twice since moving to Gaza in 2002. The first occasion was in 2011 when her mother, diagnosed with diabetes, had health problems. The second one in 2021 when one of the Soheir siblings underwent upon open heart surgery. At other times, the Israeli regime would not allow her to travel. As a result, she was unable to attend her father's funeral in 2008 and her brother's wedding in 2016. Earlier this year, the human rights group Al-Mizan reported that more than 100 women and children have submitted applications so they could move from Gaza to the West Bank. Some of the requests were made more than a decade ago, yet the Zionist regime has still not processed them. The Zionist regime's policies have often forced Palestinian families apart. Parents in Gaza sometimes have to bring up children alone, while the other parent works and lives in the West Bank. As a result, families are only able to keep in touch by telephone or the internet. The cruel permit regime enforced by the Zionist regime violates free movement rights enshrined in international humanitarian law. Salih Abu Jumeza hardly ever sees her father Qasem except via video call. Qasem moved from Gaza to the West Bank about 13 years ago, finding work in a clothing factory. Salih, now in her mid-20s, got married in March. Qasem was not able to attend the wedding. "He had no choice," said Qasem's wife and Salih's mother, Tasahil, adding, "He can only attend family occasions via video call." As soon as he moved to the West Bank, Qasem filed an application so his family could join him there. But the Zionist regime has never granted him the required permission. Since moving to the West Bank, Qasem has visited his family in Gaza just 3 times. Each visit only lasted a few days. The travel permits issued to him by the fabricated regime of Israel would have expired if he stayed any longer. 4 years have passed since his last trip. Qasem fears that the Zionist regime would prevent him from leaving Gaza and that he would thereby lose the chance of re-entering the West Bank. Tasahil, his wife, says he has been trying to get the family back together for years. He doesn't want to destroy those efforts by spending 3 days in Gaza, even if it means sacrificing his happiness.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Black and white.
El conocimiento, la experiencia histórica ha confirmado.
Our understanding and historical experiences have confirmed thousands of times the truthfulness of what Che Guevara proposed to us. We shall not believe imperialism at all. Imperialism's agreements and negotiations are always against the nations they oppress. 100 years have passed since the Sykes-Picot Agreement. It was an agreement that aimed to put the Middle East under the dominance of two European powers.
De dos potencias principalmente europeas, todo lo que es el Oriente Medio.
I'm talking about France and Britain. These two countries simply took the power without taking into account the people, their aspirations, their desire, and their sovereignty.
A su soberanía.
They marked the map and divided the area of influence and exploitation. Undoubtedly, this agreement was accompanied with treason, intrigue, bullets, bombs, and a multilateral cultural subjugation of all kinds. This phenomenon can lead us to understand the struggles of the peoples of the Middle East for their sovereignty and independence. Clearly, imperialism today is in decline. I'm referring to European imperialism. That is obviously responsible for what is happening in the Middle East. The Sykes-Picot Agreement was arranged without people's knowledge, in silence and secretly. But the agreement was kept as a secret for a year and a half because the nascent Soviet state made it public. The Lenin government announced it in two newspapers, Vestia and Pravda. But in addition to that, the Soviet state made the decision to renounce the spaces that was given to Russia, since this was a year before the Tsarist Russia was in the spaces that would correspond to them in sharing out of the Middle East. That move was a great contribution of the nascent Soviet Socialist Republic to sovereignty and independence in the Middle East. Unquestionably, the Sykes-Picot Agreement was signed at a time when the First World War had practically ended. The Ottoman Empire was in absolute decline, and the Western powers found the space and the opportunity to place their claws, but not only satisfied with that, they wanted to secure an enclave. Britain and France secretly had something out there. Tsarist Russia and also the influence of the English Zionist groups made the deal. And for that, they set their sights not only on dominance over the countries and peoples there, but also on installing a Western beachhead in the Middle East. And there we have the British protectorate over Palestine and subsequently the birth of the Zionist entity of Israel in 1948 as a consequence of this treaty. That is why this agreement is very important. It's important to see what the aggression against Syria means today, what the Iraq War in 2003 and the invasion of Iraq meant. What it means to marginalize, rip apart the territory and the Palestinian population with the permanent attacks. But the history is not static, and contradictions at the international level sometimes also give space to the peoples and just causes. A day like this, the Ottoman Empire went into decline and created new conditions. Today, the decline of the West, Western Europe, and of the United States is giving a new opportunity to the peoples of the Middle East, and particularly Palestine, to uphold and achieve sovereignty and independence. I'm Eduardo Artes. This is Black and White.
Bueno.
In today's program, I talk to Rodrigo Carmi. He is an academic and researcher at the Center for Arab Studies and the Department of Philosophy at the University of Chile. You're very welcome, Rodrigo. This is Black and White.
It's an honor for me to be in this program with you, Professor.
Thank you very much to be with us. Events always have a background and also subsequent impacts. How did Sykes-Picot agreement influence the today Middle East? What are the consequences of such agreement that we have already talked about? What impacts of such agreement are on today's map of the Middle East? There are also some contradictions among countries about that agreement and about the presence of Western powers, fundamentally Anglo-Saxons, in the Middle East. Could you please explain these points?
Well, I have to mention two points. The first one is that we have to point out that Sykes-Picot was a secret agreement between France and Britain in which the territory that the Ottoman Turkish Empire had abandoned was distributed and the presence of Western powers was consolidated in some way from 1915 onwards in the region. The agreement actually targeted important places because it consolidated the presence of Western powers in the Middle East in the deterioration of the Ottoman Turkish Empire of the time. The second issue that is relevant is that this agreement establishes the first national state borders of the modern Arab states that are going to be consolidated later in the decolonization processes. This same point explains that the decolonization itself was based on the borders established by the others in this case. It was carried out by Western powers that hatched the secret agreement.
It is a matter that has curiously attracted my attention, and I need you to explain it for me, please. What role did the United Arab Republic play in creating Syria, Egypt, etc.? Was it like getting out of what was already planned?
Yes, that's right. Pan-Arabism is one of the great popular national discourses, was formed during the decolonization processes fundamentally under the leadership of Jamal Abdel Nasser. They precisely tried to tension the other borders. One of these tensions had to do with the implementation of this United Arab Republic. I would say that there were two decisive issues that troubled that same republic. The first was an internal matter in which Egypt established hegemony over Syria. Therefore, it wasn't a United Republic, but was subsumed. The second issue is related to the Six-Day War. That was an imperialist war urged by Israel. This war ends up weakening the popular Arab national discourse in a very extensive way and generating a halt to decolonization processes, particularly in the case of Egypt, which is more relevant. There is one last issue that I would like to explain about Sykes-Picot agreement and is related to the present time. Today, we are witnessing in a very profound way a crisis of the fictional purposes established by the Sykes-Picot agreement. To me, this matter is related to two fundamental issues. The first point is the progressive hegemonic withdrawal of the Western powers from the Middle East and the progressive advance of other powers that begin to have a much more fundamental presence in the region like China and Russia. These countries were key players in the staging of the correlation of forces in the Middle East. This is the first issue. And the second issue is related to Daesh case, which is really interesting. Daesh emerges in the post-Arab Spring context and in the midst of the civil war in Syria. The Daesh project was precisely planned to wipe out the borders of the Sykes-Picot agreement. Creation of Daesh meant the destruction of Sykes-Picot borders. It was actually a kind of perverse way to show this plan by Daesh, which also revealed Sykes-Picot agreement's defects.
It is interesting that some groups constantly claim to be right and just by hiding their real faces, but having their own evil purposes, just like Daesh.
Exactamente. O sea, un proyecto totalmente siniestro. That's exactly right. It was actually part of the wicked plan that aimed to show that the only alternative that the region had was to prove that Sykes-Picot agreement wasn't practical anymore. What we're witnessing today is evidently a large-scale geopolitical reconfiguration in the Middle East. I think that they're now the new actors that are going to distribute the areas of influence in the Middle East in a peaceful way, and at the same time generating promising economic exchange. On the other hand, there is also a new version of the Sykes-Picot agreement, but not in favor of Western powers.
I think that there is an issue that we don't have same opinions on it. I think that diplomatic relations, bilateral trade, and certain influence in the region don't mean an unfair agreement on imperialism. Let's have a break, and then we continue our program.
Ni es sinónimo de imperialismo.
No, por supuesto.
Vamos a un corte y continuamos con el tema.
Rodrigo, before the break, I was telling you that as far as I'm concerned, we can't compare trade relations and influences with an imperialist policy because the Sykes-Picot agreement was an interventionist and imperialist agreement. Are agreements always unfair or are there some exceptions?
Yes, not all exchange is a capitalist exchange, but in this case, we have a capitalist exchange for capitalism, which is ultimately the global exchange. What I was saying that the emergence of new powers that have influences in the Middle East have pushed back Western influence in some way. The interesting point is that there are different scenarios in this case. There is an inter-imperialist struggle, but there is also a struggle within the Arab countries and non-Arab countries, but Muslims like Iran with Muslim Arab countries like Saudi Arabia. These two countries had historical disagreements that not only goes back to the assassination of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr in 2016, but goes back to the time of the triumph of the Islamic Republic in Iran in 1979. The Saudis have always wanted to be a regional hegemony within the Middle East, and they have not managed to be successful because they have faced Egyptians and Iranians ahead of themselves. To me, the important issue is to understand the modern geopolitical reality that can have other forms and reconfiguration of imperialism. In this sense, it seems to me that what is being carried out with Saudi Arabia and Iran as key geopolitical actors in the Middle East that are trying to divide the areas of influence, both at the economic and political levels. For instance, in case of Yemen, they are negotiating to put an end to the civil war. The same strategy is being implemented in Syria, where Syrians have negotiations with their Russian and Turkish counterparts. There is actually an interesting reconfiguration at regional level that has an important aspect. The hegemony of the Western powers is completely in debacle. There are new actors, both regional and Asian.
Tanto regionales como asiático.
Mira, yo personalmente creo que
I personally agree with you that there is a reconfiguration in all terms. I would like to ask you a question that seems interesting, and we mostly forget to mention. What happens to the people of these countries? Because we always expect the Arab and Middle Eastern nations in general to raise their voices. And for me, at least, the most important thing is to focus on this issue in this scenario.
What you're mentioning is really important. What is taking shape is a fight between tectonic plates of a very important geopolitical nature. By that, I mean the emergence of the Euro-Asian on the one hand and the Euro-Atlantic setback on the other hand in a set of local conflicts that are being resolved in the way that leads to this great earthquake. The interesting point is that this worldwide political earthquake produces cracks that are nobody's zones. They're not the zones of the Eurasian world, nor are they zones of the Euro-Atlantic world. I would say that this is where the people are raising their voices. The Arab revolts of 2011 and the continuation of these revolts that took place in various other countries are interesting for a very key reason. These revolts not only took place in pro-Western countries, but also in countries that are under the protection of Iran, like Syria and Iraq in 2019. The 2019 Iraqi uprising is interesting because it had two goals. They protested against the U.S. military presence and demanded withdrawal of the United States troops and also against the Iranian administration that had been established there. It seems to me that there we can find the gaps. I think that the people are raising their voices in this third place within this geopolitical dualism that is deepening every day. However, it is very interesting that this issue can bring about promising issues, particularly regarding the Palestinian cause.
Particularmente si uno piensa, por ejemplo, respecto a la cuestión palestina.
Mira, antes de entrar en el tema palestino, sí, yo creo que es interesante.
Before talking about the Palestinian cause, I think that your opinions are interesting and respectable. I think that the Arab Spring was more likely the Arab Winter. There was Western intervention and control, even in knocking down and punishing totally Western-like regimes. But this same issue caused a problem because maintaining the dominance meant dealing with uprisings of other characteristics, right? Well, let's talk about the Palestinian issue. How is the situation of Palestine nowadays since the creation of the Zionist entity based on the Sykes-Picot Agreement with the help of Britain at the time of the collapse of Ottoman Empire? How Western European countries and the U.S. that are in deep evident crisis and decline support the Zionist and Israeli regime in different aspects, such as ideological, cultural, military, and economic.
Al sionismo y al Estado israelí.
I will tell you that the Palestinian issue was raised precisely at the time of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which implied the division of British territories. In that time, a piece of Palestinian land ended up being part of the British mandate in Palestine, and later we have the revolts of the 1930s against the British mandate. The Zionist mobilization is very important because it was fully supported by Great Britain. Meanwhile, the Zionists were successful in issuance of the Balfour Declaration in 1917. There is a change of mind by British imperialism between the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the Balfour Declaration. Before 1915, the British supported the formation of Arab national states to ally with the Arab national movements against the Ottoman Turkish Empire. But when the Ottoman Turkish Empire began to show signs of a solution during the First World War, Great Britain changed its mind and said, "What interests us is precisely having a colonial presence through the figure of mandate and protectorate, and Palestine is also there. Palestine is in the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and it is also mentioned in the Balfour Declaration, which is very important. The Balfour Declaration is the first official document from the British government that gives a resolute support to the Zionist movement for future colonizations. It seems to me that in this sense, the Palestinian issue is also influenced due to this Western withdrawal and problems of the Sykes-Picot Agreement that is being also experienced in the present time. This matter can have fundamental and immediate consequences, and the important one is related to the crisis within the Palestinian National Authority. Let's remember that the Palestinian National Authority is a body that emerges and is institutionally created along with the Oslo Accords of 1992 and 1923, signed by Yasser Arafat and mediated by the U.S. Let's say that Oslo Accords are equivalent to the Chilean transition to democracy. The Palestinian National Authority is in crisis today because they have tried to show their completely subservient face to Israeli colonization interests. So in Palestinian politics, there is a very interesting crisis that can have a very decisive recreational level, which is the delegitimization of the Palestinian National Authority and the emergence of other movements, including other strategies such as the armed strategy to claim independence and in some way show the importance of historical Palestine against Zionist project. The agreement that was signed by Iran and Saudi Arabia under Chinese mediation recently is very interesting because it actually pushes Israel out of the game.
Deja fuera de juego a Israel, ¿no?
Mira, sí, justamente, mira.
That's right. We're about to finish our program. Please explain to us briefly about the consequences that such agreements could bring about on Israel.
Israel wanted to fully co-opt with the Arab countries, particularly with the petro-monarchies since the Abraham Accords. But what Saudi Arabia did was precisely to get out of this possible cooperation with Israel, and then this decision could have other interesting consequences for the Palestinians and for the Israelis as well. In this case, Israelis will be left without any alternatives, despite the fact that the Saudis have always been complicit in some way with the Israelis. It also opens other perspectives that we do not know about them yet.
Thank you very much, Rodrigo, for having this interview with us.
In the limelight. Former U.S. Vice President Mike Pence refuted the notion that President Trump only asked him to delay the counting of electoral votes on 6th of January 2021 to allow for audits of state election results. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former Vice President Mike Pence refuted the notion that former President Donald Trump only asked him to delay the counting of electoral votes on 6th of January 2021 to allow for audits of state election results, disputing the characterization of their interactions made by some members of Trump's legal team. That's not what happened, Mike Pence said during an interview with Face the Nation that aired on Sunday, 6th of August. From sometime in the middle of December, the president began to be told that I had some authority to reject or return votes back to the states. He added, I had no such authority. On Tuesday, 1st of August, Donald Trump was indicted for a second time on federal charges. This most recent indictment stemmed from his efforts to remain in power after losing the 2020 presidential election, efforts which culminated in the violent attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021. The indictment included four charges against Trump: conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. One of the allegations against Donald Trump is that he attempted to enlist Mike Pence to use his ceremonial role in affirming the electoral vote count on 6th of January 2021 to fraudulently overturn the results of the election. Mike Pence has said Donald Trump went beyond asking him to pause the count for an audit and urged him to reject the Biden electors outright in the hopes of tipping the election in Trump's favor. There was no discretion ever given to the vice president in history, nor should there ever be, Mike Pence told Face the Nation. I had no right to overturn the election,
and Kamala Harris will have no right to overturn the election when we beat them in 2024. John Lauro, an attorney for Donald Trump, responded to Mike Pence's comments on Sunday, telling Face the Nation that his position is consistent with Pence's version of events. What I said is the ultimate ask of Vice President Pence was to pause the count and allow the states to weigh in. That was my statement, and what I've said is consistent with what Vice President Mike Pence is saying. The reason why Vice President Pence will be so important to the defense is, number one, he agrees that John Eastman, who gave legal advice to President Trump, was an esteemed legal scholar. Number two, he agrees that there were election irregularities, fraud, unlawful actions at the state level. All of that will eviscerate any allegation of criminal intent on the part of President Trump. The indictment refers to contemporaneous notes taken by the vice president in the weeks leading up to 6th of January 2021, when prosecutors alleged Trump repeatedly pressured him to reject the electoral votes. From time to time, particularly at important moments, I had a practice of scribbling a note or two on my calendar just to memorialize it and remember it, and I did that in this case, he told Face the Nation. I generally didn't make a practice of taking notes in meetings over the four-year period of time. But given the momentous events that were unfolding, he said he took a few notes to remind himself of what had been said. From very early on, the very first time the president raised the issue with me that he was being told that I had the right to overturn the election to reject or return votes, I told him I knew I had no such authority. I truly do believe that no one whoever puts himself over the Constitution should ever be President of the United States. The former Vice President also recalled an occasion before Christmas 2020 when Donald Trump asked him what he thought we ought to do. We were just the two of us in the Oval Office, Pence said. I remember I looked at him and said, look, let all the lawsuits play out, let the Congress do their work to consider objections. But I said at the end of the day, if the election goes the other way, I said we ought to take a bow, we ought to travel around the country, he said. And I remember the president is standing in front of his desk, listening very intently to me.